This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The debate over freedom of speech and protecting it on college campuses in Wisconsin is in another round. Republican lawmakers in the Assembly have reintroduced a bill that would make some changes to how free speech is regulated and protected on campuses. That would create some significant punishments for public universities and technical colleges that are found to be in violation of students' or employees' rights. You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the current state of free speech and expression policies at Wisconsin's institutions of higher learning? Are there changes you'd like to see? Do you have questions about what is in this legislation? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Rich Kramer is a reporter for WPR who covers higher education. Rich, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, Rob, thanks for having me.
Now, you reported this is the fourth time we've seen Republican lawmakers circulate a bill like this one. What are the sponsors' main goals as they talk about this?
Well, the main goals, as per the testimony that I've heard a few times now over the years, is to ensure that campuses aren't, first of all, that they're educating students about free speech rights, the First Amendment of the Constitution, and making sure that there are some penalties for campuses or administrators or anyone who violates that. So it's been an ongoing discussion about, you know, what does free speech on campus really mean and essentially who decides.
Before we dig into the details of the legislation, Rich, what has happened in the past? How far along in the process did a similar legislation get?
Well, basically the bills, and maybe Joe can correct me later on, but the bills have been introduced. There's been some amendments, but they just haven't finished, you know, they haven't crossed the finish line before the end of the session. And, you know, part of that is there's hundreds of bills considered every single session. And, you know, lawmakers have priorities that change from time to time. But these free speech bills, which have changed a little bit over the, you know, the various iterations, they just haven't gotten a full vote, as far as I know, on the in the state assembly or in the state senate. And I know for a fact that they've never made it to the governor's desk.
Mm-hmm. Now let's look at some of the particulars here. One would be requiring regular surveys of students and employees around, as you just mentioned, that First Amendment knowledge, perceived political bias, culture of censorship. We had a survey along these lines. There was some controversy. Can you talk about its role in this legislation, Rich?
Well, I'll say that the legislation or this idea of this bill predates that survey for what it's worth. That survey was done by the University of Wisconsin system, I believe last year, or it was the results were released last year. And the essentially it found that you know, conservative students or those that identified as conservatives among the respondents felt less free to give their opinion in class. They were worried that, first of all, their peers would kind of ostracize them. They were worried about social repercussions. They were also worried that they might get a lower grade in some cases if they brought, you know, their conservative viewpoints up in class. And it kind of goes to that idea that we've heard a lot about from conservatives that, you know, universities are generally very liberal places. That's the main ideology on campus. And that survey also found that liberal students in general were more comfortable, you know, canceling conservative speakers or canceling any speaker for their viewpoints than conservative students were.
Now, a big part of this bill has to do with consequences if any campuses, this is the public university, the University of Wisconsin system, and technical colleges, penalties if they violate norms established in this law of free speech. What could some of those penalties look like?
Well, there's a few of them that I'll rattle off here. Essentially, it would allow students or anyone really who feels that their free speech rights on campus were violated by policies or administrative actions, they could sue the UW System Board of Regents or Technical College Board at the local level. And if a judge agrees that a violation occurred, the person bringing that suit could win damages between, I believe, a minimum of $500 and a maximum of $100,000. It also would potentially result in the loss of what's known as a Wisconsin grant. That's a state grant that goes to universities used for financial aid, essentially, for students. If a university is found to have, I believe it's two violations in a 5-10 year period, something like that. And also it would require universities that were found to repeatedly violate free speech rights to post on its admissions material that goes out to prospective students a statement essentially saying we didn't follow the law with regard to free speech rights, and they'd have to keep that on their materials for 4 years as kind of a warning for prospective students.
Talking to WPR reporter Rich Kramer, he covers, among other things, higher education, looking at a bill in the state legislature aimed at promoting and protecting free speech on college campuses with, as we just heard, penalties for campuses that violate the terms of that law, if it were to become a law. Now, Rich, have we heard a response from the UW, from the technical colleges as this thing has moved along?
Yeah, there's written testimony, and there was a public testimony at the hearings from spokespeople or government relations people with the University of Wisconsin system or the Universities of Wisconsin system and the technical college boards. And in a nutshell, the UW folks say a lot of what you want to do in this bill, we already do in our regent policy. That policy is 4-21, and that changes were made to that a little while back. But proponents of these bills say you need teeth for any of this to really matter. You have to have repercussions. So the UW systems or the UW spokesperson says that, you know, those kind of punishments would adversely impact students' financial aid. That's for one. And also the tech systems had similar concern about these punishments.
And Rich, what is the next piece of this story that you're watching for to see if this legislation moves further than it has in the past?
Yeah, I guess I'll just be watching. You know, the committee had their public hearing, which is the first step, you know, after the bill has been introduced. And then they would take a vote in the executive session. Then from there, it goes potentially for a full floor vote and a full in the Assembly and Senate, and then to the governor's desk. So beyond that, I mean, I'll just be watching if this bill keeps coming up, if it doesn't make it to the finish line this go round.
Rich, thanks again for joining us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
That's WPR's Rich Kramer, a reporter who covers higher education. We talked to him today about a renewed Republican effort in the state legislature to update free speech protections on public campuses, including consequences for colleges that are found to have violated them. Coming up, we'll hear from a national group, a supporter of most of the provisions of this legislation, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. You just heard some of the basics there. We'll dig into some more of the details, and you could share your thoughts. Do you think we need to see these kind of changes? 800-642-1234 is the number, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk about free speech and expression on college campuses. Republicans in the legislature have again advanced a bill that would punish universities and technical colleges in Wisconsin that violate a set of free speech guidelines. We heard about some of the details of that bill with WPR reporter Rich Kramer. Joe Cohn joins us now, legislative and policy director for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. He testified last week before the Wisconsin Assembly Colleges and Universities Committee, largely in support of the bill while pressing for a specific change. Joe, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Rob.
I want to pick up on something Rich mentioned. The response from the university in particular is, hey, the Board of Regents, they're the agency empowered to deal with this kind of stuff. They have a policy in place. What do you see as the need for the state legislature to define things in state statute?
Well, let me say a couple things about that. The first is that, you know, FIRE rates schools' written policies on whether or not they are constitutional and with respect to free speech rights. And there are no schools in Wisconsin that get our green light rating that they're completely constitutional. So the idea that the Board of Regents have really stepped to the plate and done completely the right thing is just wrong. They've made progress. They've made important progress that they should be, you know, recognized for in adopting the Chicago Principles, which is a gold standard kind of statement of the principles at play of free speech. But when rubber hits the road, there are still policies on the ground that do not comply with the First Amendment. The second thing I would say is that the Board of Regents is unable to provide remedies to students when rights are violated, either through institutional policy or if one of their employees does the wrong thing when there's a controversy. Only having real meaningful access to courts fixes that, and the legislature is in a much better position to do that. It's either Congress or the legislature. No one else can.
What are some of the measures you see on Wisconsin public university and college campuses that that fall short of First Amendment protections?
Well, they have overbroad anti-harassment policies that don't track Supreme Court definitions of when speech crosses from being protected but maybe rude to being unprotected, discriminatory, harassing conduct. And tracking those lines is necessary because it's required under the Constitution at public schools, but it's also necessary for people to have kind of the freedom to speak their minds and interact with each other in a non-sanitized way in learning environments where we expect there to be conflict.
Yeah, in the bill, as written up by the Legislative Reference Bureau, the bill would bar, and I'm going to quote here, university rules that, here's where the quote starts, sanction individuals or groups for discriminatory harassment unless the speech targets its victims on the basis of a protected class under law and is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it effectively bars a student from receiving equal access to educational opportunities or benefits. Now, one could imagine a lot of harassment that's pretty bad that doesn't rise to that standard, and a university saying, well, hold on, we want to have a collegial atmosphere. We need to be able to enforce that. Is it hard to establish that somewhere a middle ground between, you know, we're ruining your educational experience completely on the basis of, say, a protected class versus this is worse than we want in our collegial attitude here?
Well, you know, hold on with that. First of all, that language is directly from the United States Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. It's an opinion in Davis versus Monroe County Board of Education authored by Justice O'Connor, but joined by Ginsburg, Souter, Breyer, Stevens. So it's hardly a, you know, conservative perspective on when you have to cross the lines. And the court was very careful in setting it because you expect students to argue with each other. It's the same line in the educational setting, by the way, K-12 and college. And you can see how if you don't require it to be both pervasive and and severe, if it's only one or the other, kids tease each other all the time. Kids go after each other all the time. And if in higher education, you need to be able to have robust disagreements. And, you know, quite frankly, in higher ed, you expect to have arguments and expect to have them sometimes be heated.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Brookfield. Jim, hi.
Hey there. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I think it's necessary, and it's kind of a shame to the institution that they have to be taught what free speech is. I mean, the left and the, you know, the ones who are the liberal people who are running these institutions cannot argue anymore about their policies, and then when they are faced with the argument, they have to call it hate speech. They have to shut it down. It's pretty embarrassing that this has to happen. It's not just Wisconsin. It's everywhere. And I'm glad some people are stepping up and starting to not donate, you know, to these institutions, because I think that's the only thing that's really going to make a difference is when the dollars stop rolling. And I do applaud the efforts here from your guest, and I think he's a great guest. And thanks for having him on. It's another side of this conversation. You're pretty trustworthy to do this. I appreciate that.
Jim, thanks a lot for the call. Joe, your thoughts on what Jim brought up?
Well, first of all, I want to thank him for that, and just say that there's never been a golden era of free speech on college campuses, but we are seeing levels of censorship at institutions of higher education across the country that are unprecedented. The numbers of disinvitations, the numbers of attempts to block speaking events, including circuit court judges at Stanford, you know, University Law School, for example. You know, we are seeing an unprecedented number of attempts to get faculty members fired for saying things that are controversial as well, numbers that far exceed the numbers during the entire Red Scare. So we have to take this threat very seriously. And the only way around it is, well, two prongs. One, we need laws and that require policies that comply with free speech norms. and case law. And then the second prong is that we need to work on improving a culture of free speech, which requires a culture of listening to each other, no matter what side of the aisle you're on.
Jim, thanks for the call. Talking to Joe Cohn with the Group Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE, about legislation filed by Republicans, the fourth attempt to pass something like this on free speech and expression on college campuses, and consequences if those policies aren't followed. Joe, I wanted to bring up one point on this legislation that you opposed in your testimony, and that has to do with the venue where some of these things are argued. Could involve courts, but under the legislation, it could also be a legislative committee, and you have concerns about that.
Yeah, I do. So this bill has provisions on campus free speech that we've talked about, and it has provisions on academic freedom for faculty that we haven't yet talked about. But the third section of the bill provides robust due process protections for students so they can't be expelled without fair procedures. Wisconsin is one of three and only three states in the country where there is no due process right to continued right to an education. But one problem with this bill is that it allows for a committee of the legislature to hear complaints that schools cut corners in these disciplinary proceedings. Now, that interjects politics into that process in a way that's unproductive and potentially unconstitutional with the separation of powers problem. But lastly, it's also just unwise. Do we really think the legislature's time is best spent hearing as an sitting as an appellate body over every campus due process case at all of your institutions of higher education? I don't think so.
Let's go back to our callers. Andrew is with us in Milwaukee. Andrew, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call. I was interested in hearing an opinion about the actions of Ron DeSantis in Florida, essentially outlawing pro-Palestinian student groups, and the politicization or the political appointed board of regents, and how politics could play into what is acceptable free speech or unacceptable free speech.
Andrew, thanks for the call. And Joe, I believe I saw a statement from FIRE on that issue in Florida that Andrew's talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Andrew, for that question. A lot of what's happened across the country is just unconstitutional, including what you described in Florida. You know, the right to protest is an essential part of free speech. It doesn't depend on people being right about their cause. And in fact, you know, the Constitution itself requires viewpoint-based neutrality so that we don't have those determinations when deciding who has the right to engage in protests. Now, not all of the protests will necessarily be constitutional. You can cross lines. You can block egress from buildings. That's alleged to have happened at Cooper Union in New York, where it looks like students were barricaded in a library, Jewish students, by an angry mob of protesters. That's not protected conduct. So, you know, but across the board, the right to just engage in speech in support of the Palestinian cause is protected, even if, you know, it proves, you know, over the test of time that their cause lacked merit. The First Amendment doesn't make those determinations.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Excuse me. Roger joins us in Two Harbors, Minnesota. Roger, hi.
Good afternoon. I was a student at the University of Minnesota at Duluth in 1965. The university had, at that time, I hope it still does, a strict policy of the speakers cannot incite to riot or rebellion. They have to be sponsored by a student group. We had Arnold Johnson, who was treasurer of the American Communist Party, and George Lincoln Rockwell, who was America's chief Nazi, speaking a day apart. And, of course, there was controversy, but the university officials said they met the requirements so they can speak. And the provost said even President Kennedy in 1963, 2 years earlier, had to be sponsored by a student group, the Young Democrats. And I feel that's what should be the policy. Thank you much for giving me my little speech.
Roger, thanks for the call. Joe, is that the attitude you'd like to see?
Well, you know, thanks, Roger. It certainly isn't a constitutional problem in a lot of parts of the country. The circuits are not even on this. They're not uniform on this question, but it's constitutionally allowed in a lot of the country to make a distinction between those who are invited guests and just the public's right to use university spaces. What I would say is that no matter how hateful you think some speech is, there is value to society in having it out in the open versus suppressing it, because suppressing speech doesn't eliminate those attitudes, doesn't change hearts and minds. It pushes it underground where it festers, where it metastasizes. So, you know, people do themselves a favor, you know, do our society a favor, sorry, when they put their ideas out in the public to be evaluated, scrutinized, and sometimes even viciously criticized.
Thanks for that call. Joe, as we've mentioned, this legislation in Wisconsin, the fourth try here. Do you have any sense that it is any more likely to advance further in the legislature this time around?
Well, I hope so. And we're going to be trying to get it all the way through. The lower house, you know, has a lot of drive to get this done. It's yet to be seen if the Senate is equally interested in moving this forward, but over 21 states have passed bills, and a lot of them with very broad bipartisan support. And this is one of the better bills in the country once that line we discussed is cut. It's one that doesn't take a partisan perspective on free speech rights, that mimics Supreme Court standards on different types of speech codes that are common across the country. And students of all different political persuasions will benefit from having these rights locked up into law with an ability to vindicate their rights if they're violated in court.
Joe, we'll leave it there. Provide. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Joe Cohen with the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression, or FIRE. We talked to him about his group's support for a Republican bill in the state legislature that would make some changes around free speech on college campuses in Wisconsin. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, if you feel lonely these days, you are not alone. Find out why public health experts are worried about the impacts of widespread loneliness around the United States. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. I told you a few weeks back about a record-breaking pumpkin. Now there's another pumpkin-related record, and it's a work of art. As reported by Smithsonian Magazine, the owners and staff of a farm in England just set the world record for the largest ever mural created with pumpkins, squash, and gourds. The mosaic is a good Halloween theme. It's a tribute to Jack Skellington from the movie The Nightmare Before Christmas, released 30 years ago this month. The mosaic is over 2,000 square feet, made from over 10,000 pumpkins and gourds. I learned a new word. This is a cucurbita mosaic. That's the genus name for pumpkins and close relatives. I won't try to replicate the project in my garden. One, it's too small to grow 10,000s of these cucurbita plants. Two, I haven't gotten great results just trying to grow one or two. This is Halloween on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. On Monday, President Biden announced that Wisconsin will be designated as one of 31 regional innovation and technology hubs in the country. The Technology Hubs program was authorized by the CHIPS and Science Act, signed by President Biden in August 2022. Wisconsin's Tech Hub designation will focus on supporting the state's growing biohealth sector. Here's President Biden during that announcement.
A tech hub in Wisconsin is going to bring together research labs, medical device manufacturers, and engineers. They're going to build technology that supports personalized medicine, like tests, treatments, and therapies specifically tailored to a patient's genetic code and medical records. And I believe it's going to save a lot of lives in the long run.
That's President Biden speaking early last week. A state technology and business advocate joins us now for a look at what this can mean for Wisconsin's economy and for the future of healthcare research. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in the healthcare or biohealth industry? What does this mean for your organization? Are you watching this hub with interest? Are you excited potentially about this recognition for Wisconsin's health and biohealth industries? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, a nonprofit bipartisan science and technology policy advisory board to the governor and state legislature. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Great to be back.
What does this designation as a technology hub mean? Is it just kind of a label, or does it come with a little help attached to it?
Yes. Well, it does, at least at the outset, come with some little with some help to help push things along. It is one of the 31 tech hub designations that were made by the U.S. Department of Commerce through the president's office. And it is all about precision medicine, which is also known as personalized medicine. So there were five others in that cluster out of the 31 who would be working in that area. This comes with planning money of about $350,000. And somewhere in the range of 50 to 70 million if the tech hub is fully funded moving down the road. And that's still a very competitive piece.
Before we look more at the details of what this would mean for personalized medicine, Tom, can you talk about biotechnology in Wisconsin? I think in some ways it's kind of a hidden part of the economy for a lot of people. What is included in that?
Yeah, I mean, we have long been, as a state, a center for research and clinical applications in human health for more than a century, really. I mean, it includes things such as vitamin discoveries, many of which took place at the UW-Madison, the founding of the nation's first college genetics department, which is really directly linked to precision medicine. Breakthroughs in organ transplants, cancer therapies, medical imaging, and it's, here on the Madison campus at places like Marquette and the Medical College of Wisconsin all have a piece of it, as well as our companies. That's the really important part of that structure. You know, you've got companies as large as GE Health, Exact Sciences, Epic Systems, Promega, Arrowhead Pharmaceuticals, many, many more that are in that space. So the strength of this particular tech hub application really is part on the research side, part traditionally where we are strong. And by the way, just genetic medicine in general is a part of that. And then where it intersects with clinicians and others who are making the right products and doing the right things.
Now, part of the goal, as I understand it, of these hubs around the country, Tom, is, and they said something like this in the announcement, yeah, we've got a lot of Silicon Valley type places. We got Boston and MIT, a lot of coastal technology hubs. Is this something that you see as part of the goal is here that's going to get more technology development, technology business development in places in the Midwest like Wisconsin?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, part of it is just recognizing, what are the good things that are already going on here? And this is also the tech hub designation is similar to what is going on in a parallel process through the National Science Foundation, where they have been doing and announced earlier this year regional innovation engine programs, 44 of which spread around the country. Under the type one, that means it's early, just like this tech hub is early. And two of those 44 are in Wisconsin. So, and the other one is just across the border in Chicago, and that also has a Wisconsin component. So really, right now, we have, as a state, four different proposals that are kind of on the table and could wind up with some significant federal support, along with private support, to push things ahead for years to come.
Talking to Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, about a federal designation of Wisconsin as having a biotechnology hub and giving some support to develop that here. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about what this means, about personalized medicine, which is one of the goals of this project here in Wisconsin. If you work for one of the companies Tom just mentioned or comparable ones here in the state, love to hear from you as well. Join in at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Tom, as you mentioned, genetic medicine, personalized medicine, the target of the Wisconsin hub here. So what's that going to look like? What institutions are involved? What kind of things will happen to try to develop that?
Well, I want to give credit right off the bat to some folks who did a lot of heavy lifting to move this along. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation helped convene a lot of people. BioForward is a longstanding group that is really dedicated quite vertically to what's going on with human health in Wisconsin. And so there are a variety of partners, both private and public sector, that are a part of this. And so that's an exciting part. Now, we as a tech council, we're part of all three of those NSF grants that I talked about earlier. Those are $1 million planning grants and up to $160 million over 10 years each, if those are designated. So the Water Council of Milwaukee has taken the lead on one about water, energy, and manufacturing. WISIS has taken the lead on one with sustainable agriculture. And the Quantum Computing Hub is run out of Chicago, but it includes elements of things that are going on in Wisconsin. So again, that's the four and some of the folks who've been driving it. We're pleased to be a part of those, part of that overall mix.
Now, again, with the personalized medicine in particular, what are the hopes for that field as far as things that, again, new innovations that could come out of Wisconsin?
Well, let's look at, for example, GE Healthcare, for example, and Accuray, which is both are precision medicine in the sense of medical therapies, targeted radiation, for example. Shine Technologies in Janesville and North Star Radioactive Isotopes are both producing or will be producing isotopes that are used and can be very targeted in all kinds of treatments that are common today. And then, on that genetic side, really at the end of the day, personalized medicine is trying to find the right treatment, the right technique, bring it to the right people based on their makeup, based up on how they might be ill, what their genetic makeup looks like. And it's really all about having it precise versus more general, which was the practice for years and years.
I talked to the author of a book a while back who raised red flags about personalized medicine, saying, in effect, we'd get a lot more bang for our buck if we boosted access to, primary care physicians in rural areas, low-income areas, things like that. I don't know. Is there a worry, Tom, that we're putting money into this kind of gosh wow stuff when there's lower-hanging fruit out there?
Well, and remember that in all of these cases with, precision medicine, with the tech hub, whether it's the Wisconsin proposal or the one in Minneapolis or Philadelphia or Birmingham, all of them are building on work that has already been done. And they're trying to bring it to the next level. So, yes, should we be thinking more about rural health? I think the answer is yes. But do these efforts take away from that? No, because I think precision medicine can be just as easily used by places like the Marshfield Clinic, which covers a lot of rural Wisconsin, as in some of the big urban hospitals. So I think it can apply wherever people live and work.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Liz is with us in Lyon. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Liz? We put Liz back on hold, I think. Liz, there you go. Hi, what did you want to bring up, Liz? No, I think we lost her. We'll see if we can get her back on. In the meantime, Tom Still is president of the Wisconsin Technology Council with us for a look at the recent news that Wisconsin is receiving $750 million in federal funding to boost biohealth technology in the state. Whether the state's new technology hub status is just a buzzword or could lead to meaningful growth in the field in the future, you could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about Wisconsin being designated a tech hub by the federal government, about Wisconsin's biotechnology and health research industries and academics, for that matter. If you are a part of this kind of research, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Wisconsin Technology Council President Tom Still about Wisconsin's designation as a regional technology hub, what it means for healthcare technology and innovation in the state. That comes with $75 million in federal funding to boost biohealth research. I think I said $750 million, $75 million. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about what this is, what it means, about biotechnology and its and research and its role in Wisconsin's economy? Maybe you could tell us about its role in your personal economy if you work in these fields. Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Liz in Lyon now. Liz, hi, what did you want to bring up?
Hi, I was just wondering what these companies are perhaps doing about making continuous glucose monitors, insulin pumps, and just general insulin cheaper and more available to people who have not as good insurance or no insurance at all.
Liz, thanks for the call. Tom, I don't know if that'll be part of the research hub here in Wisconsin, but I think there's a lot of interest in providing access to good insulin tech, diabetes-related technology.
Right. There are, of the 31 tech hubs that were designated, 11 of them are in medicine and health. So just so people know that it's other things like energy and quantum and critical minerals and all of that that will be a part of this program too. Now, of those other 11 that are in medical, I'm sure that they're going to be mostly not in the group that Wisconsin's in, but the other group is going to be about pharma ingredients, fermentation, biomanufacturing, vaccine-related work, biologics manufacturing. Those are going to be in other hubs where that kind of study and advancements can take place. And by the way, the one in Wisconsin is $350,000 for a planning grant and a chance to compete for up to $70 million per hub to work with private businesses, increase competitiveness, and, of course, in the case of these health hubs, save and improve lives. So I would suspect that somewhere out there, there will be an effort to work on things such as insulin pumps and the future of insulin and what else comes with that. So it's just probably not in this precision medicine cluster that Wisconsin's a part of.
Liz, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom, can you talk some more about biotechnology's role in Wisconsin's economy? How big a deal is it for communities around the state?
Well, it's really a big deal in several ways. First, there's some of the major companies that I mentioned. The Exact Sciences and Promegas and Epic Systems is not necessarily, biotech, obviously not. They're about medical records. But companies like that, that's a big part. There are other emerging companies that are really becoming a big part of the economy in Wisconsin. Some clustered in Madison area, some in Milwaukee area, but around the state as well. There are emerging companies. In fact, we have a conference next week where there's going to be some of those companies presenting. And then you have investors around the state who are also investing in some of those, especially young companies. So there's a lot of ways that it's really happening. I mean, when you look at major research institutions, the UW-Madison, the Medical College of Wisconsin, Marshfield Clinics, those are folks who are bringing in research dollars, always have, in fairly big amounts that can be a part of the economy as well. And finally, you don't have to be a biotech company or a digital imaging company to take part in the supply chain. So you often see these companies buying very close to home from folks who are in other sectors of the economy across Wisconsin.
Tom, there's an argument that the market should be making these decisions. Why have the federal involvement? Why the competition for $75 million for these various hubs? these things will find their own way through?
The private sector has moved a lot on it, but with some, you know, some things, and you could look at some of the history of federal intervention around science and technology over time. If you go back to 1945, there was the Endless Frontier, which Vannevar Bush, who was an advisor to President Truman, advised that here's how we're going to get some things done in this country moving ahead in a post-war environment. And it included creating the National Science Foundation. If you look a little farther along, there's the start of the space age. There's been some federal involvement in a variety of technologies that are in the health space, especially around what's going on with genetics and other types of really, you know, personalized medicine. And now this. So it's not an entirely unusual amount or unprecedented way for the federal government to get involved. And here, it really, especially with the NSF, and I think this is the case with the Tech Hub too, the NSF really wants this to become a private sector initiative over time. This is money they see as being used to jumpstart great projects and then move them ahead and help create jobs and really make the country much more resilient in so many different areas.
Talking to Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, about a federal designation of Wisconsin as a technology hub, specifically for biotechnology, some financial support, possibly more in the offing from the federal government. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions. Let's go back to our callers. Madeline is with us in Green Bay. Madeline, hi.
Hi. I hope that there'll be something about this that will help to deal with Lyme disease. Wisconsin is the fourth state in the nation with Lyme disease and all the autoimmune issues that come with it. And the tourism is a big economy thing in Wisconsin. But it's such a beautiful state, but you got to be afraid to go in the woods. So I hope they do something about Lyme disease.
Madeline, thanks for the call. Tom, we're maybe getting ahead of the research a little here, but is there any hope for personalized medicine related to Lyme disease, to autoimmune disorders, and more?
It feels to me like it's more a matter of generalized biologics. You know, and again, it might not take place here in Wisconsin, but it may. There's parts of this that could be applicable in different companies, different hubs. But for example, Kansas City has a hub around biologics, and that's going to, you know, not that far away. And the caller is exactly right. I mean, there are things that are everyday conditions or diseases that may be touched by this project over time. Either here in Wisconsin or one of these other places that have made it through the cut. And by the way, I think there were something like 400 different entities that applied for a tech hub grant and designation. And so it feels pretty good that Wisconsin is among them, and the same with those NSF programs.
Thanks for the call, Madeline. And Tom, as you mentioned, we made the cut for this tech hub designation. That's not the end of the competitive process, though, to get the bigger grants. What is next? What are the next steps to get from here to there?
Well, you're exactly right, Rob. I think it's having the right planning and the right involvement of all those different entities that we've been talking about, whether it's big companies, emerging companies, private investors who maybe, you know, want to take a look at some of the things that are happening. The combination of the existing research in the public sector as well as in the private sector, I think is probably one of the things that really tipped it to our advantage. Plus, we're a good state for medical manufacturing. Let's take, for example, Accuray. They bought TomoTherapy in Madison not too long ago. They're a California-based company. Guess what? They're moving all of their operations to Wisconsin and Madison. So there's talent here. There's the ability to get things done, get them produced, and to research them. So I think it's that total package that probably really interested the Department of Commerce in the Wisconsin Tech Hub.
And Tom, as we wrap up, let's talk about Wisconsin's reputation. I think if people outside the state think of, you know, what's made in Wisconsin, they might think of beer, cheese, and Harleys. Nothing wrong with those. But do you think that Wisconsin's reputation is starting to include being a center for technology and science?
I totally agree, and that it is getting better. And you know, think about these areas. Biohealth has been a part of Wisconsin flavor for years. It's reached the point now where people are beginning to recognize it coast to coast. With the NSF hubs, the notion of fresh water, energy innovation, manufacturing, one of the top three manufacturing states in the country, sustainable agriculture, that's the WISIS grant. I mean, you know, who does agriculture better than Wisconsin? And then computing, where we have seen a lot of growth in that strength. So I really do think that this is a critical moment to message people around the country, around the world, that Wisconsin really has all that it takes in this new tech age, as well as what it takes to succeed in some of the success, older sectors that are still very, very prolific.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, you're so welcome, Rob. Thank you.
Been talking to Tom Still, president of the Wisconsin Technology Council, a nonprofit bipartisan science and technology policy advisory board. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, social media sites use our personal data a lot. Now here comes artificial intelligence. We'll look at our privacy in the age of AI. This is Central Time.